instantly recognizable to everyone in the world, including himself. Why so rubbery, so dead-looking?
"My insides turned out," he says.
He's also an artist, a sculptor. He invites me to his dilapidated garage studio, where he's created hundreds of molds of human body parts using aluminum foil, glue, and scotch tape.
"Are the parts yours?" I ask.
"Mostly,"
he says. Shiny, crinkly. Hands, feet, torsos, ears, elbows, toes, even teeth. On one wall hangs a series of faces.
"All mine."
On another, a series of penises.
"Not all mine."
It's fascinating in an overly intimate kind of way, kinky and very medieval.
"I got more,"
he says. Art has saved him, because the only time he can stand still is when he's working. Then he confides, he's never shown his work to anyone except his dog, a rescue greyhound he calls Chum. Not even his daughter.
"I don't really see her,"
he says.
"Fucked up too many times."
He gets into it, how she was born premature, how he was stationed overseas, how his wife left him for his best friend from college, and as he talks, he bounces one knee, then the other, and his pupils recede like he's transported in time. When we say goodbye, he shakes my hand, his hot and vigorous, and I feel honored somehow, humbled. The next time I run into El Pollo on Main Street, his eyes are all buggy, and he's yelling at a parking meter. Pumped on amphetamines, probably bipolar too, symptoms exacerbated by his PTSD. That doesn't make him any less interesting. But when I email a couple of my old editors, it turns out no one wants a story about another crazy vet. I write it up anyway. A week later, I get called for art assistant. The proprietor is a thin, purple-wearing lady, long gray hair in a ponytail, pale skin that looks easily bruised. Hen-like, soft-spoken, she explains to me about her cats, how Austin has been puking up hairballs all morning, how Abby likes to nap under the easel. She pours through my resume, taps with her pencil on the linen-textured paper. English? Tap. Journalism? World teach. Tap. And why did you spend so much time in South America? When you are... She waves her pencil in the air, that circular wave people resort to when they're blocked. Chinese American? Chinese! She taps again. That's very far away from Costa Rica. Tap. Bolivia? Tap. Colombia, Ecuador, Brazil? Tap, tap, tap. I'm flustered, confused. For a second, my brain feels like it's full of holes. She waits expectantly. But what would it be, I wonder, to conduct one's life as a Chinese life instead of just a life? I speak Chinese. I cook Chinese food. Practice Tai Chi on occasion and drink oolong tea. But to flaunt one's authenticity seems terribly gauche. I'm human first, aren't I? Aren't we all? Is there something special about these countries? Oh, yes. The face, so open, puzzled. Yes, well... In China, the traditional music is played by the arhu, that one-string instrument that sounds like a dying cat. But in Latin American countries, they play salsa and merengue, and even the old people go to parties and dance. I know it sounds silly, simplistic, but it's the best I can do to convey it. The essence, these cultural differences captured in a nutshell.
Purple Lady frowns.
Very serious.
I'm afraid I'm not familiar, she says. She continues tap-tapping. Then, do you like working with people?
Oh, yes, I love people.
Wonderful. The wrinkles on her forehead smooth themselves out. And can you tell me why you'd like to work here?
I blank again, but I tell the truth. News is high stakes, high stress all the time, deadline-driven, and I don't know if I can take the all-nighters anymore. I mention I've been through a few rough patches lately, and outcomes from my condition improve with minimized stress. It's what the doctors always say.
Oh.
She nods. She promises to get back to me in 3 or 4 days. I get in my car. I hear her voice like an echo.
Oh.
Purple Lady doesn't call. I call a week later. She says sorry, she's found a better fit. I drive to pick up Manny from the pig. I don't say anything. He pulls my head to his shoulder, rests his cheek on my forehead. That's when the little voice in my ear calls, Mama. Essie, my baby's first words. I whip around, but her eyes are already closed. I don't tell Beige about Purple Lady. I don't tell him anything about the job situation, though he asks politely and seems contrite, as if he's gone back and read some professional manual and is now trying extra hard to contain his subconscious biases against people with my diagnosis. He's just a person, I suppose, not some robotic insect after all. Instead, we talk history. He asks about my first episode.
Insight is so important, he says.
First time it happened. It. The zing. Freshman year of college, I was visiting the art museum, staring at Picasso's Girl Before a Mirror. The painting felt curiously bright. 10 minutes I stood there. You couldn't have pried off my eyes. And then came my reward. The colors bubbled like something alien, and the girl's body parts came to life. First, her breasts jiggled, like ornaments dangling on a Christmas tree. Then her stomach growled. Then, half her cubist face laughed openly at me, while the other half distorted into a leer. Oh, Picasso, what a trick! I thought, enthralled by my own dreamlike state. Well, the girl was me, of course, with one face for myself, one for everyone else, the people of the world. But no, that was wrong. There were the in-betweens, my mother, my sister, my roommates, my friends, and my boyfriends, never quite satisfying, though why relationships did or didn't work, I still couldn't figure. Maybe I needed more faces, one for each person I knew, or maybe infinite, for each new person I was still to meet. And then it hit me. Oh, great master, revealing to me the ways of human nature, the ideal of the soulmate, why true love was so hard to find. Zing! The faces. We each had too many faces. I took out my sketch pad, crayons to paper. I drew furiously. Circles, squares, triangles, color-coded for physical, intellectual, emotional needs, sense of humor, artistic appreciation, sexual adeptness, musical tastes, compatibility for travel and confinement in small spaces. If I could capture it on paper, create an artistic representation of human relationships, then it would finally all make sense. I rushed to my dorm room. I skipped lunch and dinner. I sketched the whole night in the dark, afraid that light would interfere with the synaptic conductions in my brain. By the next afternoon, the electricity had subsided. I squinted at pages and pages of my multicolored scribbles,
trying to reconjure the excitement. But the connections, they were gone. Later, ravenous, I went out for pizza with a group of dorm mates, perfectly content to be one of the pack. It wasn't obvious then that anything was wrong. But the serpents, maybe they were born that day. Every now and then I'd hear tiny cries or whispers, like when background music played at a coffee shop, or when air rushed through the trees. Too porous to catch, they slipped in and out. But slowly, I learned to divine their special messages, through the words on a billboard or a passing truck, in the patterns of traffic lights.
"The juice is loose. Share the road."
Red, 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 green. Maybe I started to court them, seek them. I fantasized about my very own muse. Summer after freshman year, I taught English abroad. Luck, or fate, put me in Quito, where I was thrown into communal life. Giant shared house full of gringos and pool tables, and no hot water. Co-op-style dinners taken out on the front stoop at dusk. Tacos, or spaghetti, or vegetarian stir-fries. Pineapple-crushed ice late night. 10 weeks stretched forever. Friendships on fast-forward, forged on the morning walk to the bodega, or a bumpy bus ride, or a jungle hike. Cemented by nightfall, sprouting into love affairs with students, or taxi drivers, or salseros, or bullfighters. Oh, golden summer. Each day sharp and transformative, glowing and singular. Each moment a glittery embrace. People think of home as a single fixed place. But when I went traveling, I found the community of extended family I'd never had. Later, I learned there's a Spanish word for this, querencia. It refers to that place in the ring where a bull feels strongest, safest, where it returns again and again to renew its strength. It's the place we're most comfortable, where we know who we are, where we feel our most authentic selves. I headed back to Latin America after graduation, propelled by the breeze of twentieshood. Each time I set foot in a new city or town or forgotten fishing village, I felt like I'd been recharged, remade. And the beautiful people smiled or stared or stopped to talk, welcomed me into their shops, their gardens, their huts, their shacks, introduced me to their children and sisters and tías and abuelas, fed me yapingachos and fritatas and ceviches and soups. And I swelled with bliss. Those days were forever, life pouring into me all thick and spicy, and I was bottomless. It's like this, I think, to be happy. But as time passed, I sensed tiny impulses like electric shocks, allusions to the next adventure. Somewhere there was more. True calling, ready for embarkation. True love waiting to be found. One day I woke, and I knew it was done. After 3 years away, I returned to the States. I was convinced I had important work to do, to document the world. I plowed through my journalism program, 3 internships, got hired by a weekly in Connecticut after graduation. I pitched a story to an editor who had visited our investigative journalism class. And, to my amazement, she said yes. That summer, I spent 6 weeks in Vietnam, researching a story on mail-order brides. The scene was tense, seedy, grim. Yet what work could be more exhilarating? I befriended a family with 6 homely daughters, 5 sold off to Taiwanese businessmen.
The eldest had just committed suicide. The youngest, enlisted, awaited her fate. I staked out university cafes, karaoke ohms, the nyanyis, where rooms rented by the hour. True calling found. I would become a spy, penetrate borders, bridge cultural divides, infiltrate the sleazy shadow worlds of Asia, Cambodia, Thailand, Laos, even North Korea. One day I decided I no longer needed a silly American disguise. I stopped eating, bathing, wore the same clothes for weeks. Exteriors didn't matter to the people of the world. I interviewed bouncers and garbage men and prostitutes, the homeless who looked not too unlike myself after a while. My mission, to tell their stories, to become a voice, their savior. By the time it became obvious, I'd crossed the threshold, lost all capacity to distinguish what was real from what was not. The professional term for this, I learned much later, is conversion. And suddenly everyone I knew spoke in worried whispers. And this alarmed me. I had to reassure them that they'd all be just fine. I lost my job in Connecticut, but told myself it had been too restrictive anyway. After all, the people were in every neighborhood in New York, even in Providence, where I lived on Gia's couch for a while. At times, my burden felt so overwhelming, I physically froze. My brain emptied, and all my thoughts seemed to float into a comic strip bubble 2 feet above my head. Words felt sticky, gummy, like the old typewriter I used in the 7th grade. Soon, I was convinced some higher authority had bugged my bedroom, tampered with my computer, my email, forged handwritten notes with my name. I couldn't sleep. I didn't eat. And then the serpents came.
"She is sitting in the middle of the street. Stupid girl, sitting in the street. Under the manhole cover, she thinks there's a man."
It was a stern policewoman who found me, hands clamped over my ears, singing at the top of my lungs. I was brought to the emergency room. It was Gia who came, who physically restrained me from leaving the waiting area until I was seen and involuntarily committed. That first hospital stay, I was a compliant patient, a sweet Asian doll. And for this, I was branded with a severe, lifelong mental illness. Later, I would be told I had a 20% chance of maintaining a full-time job, a 25% chance of living independently, a 40% chance of attempting suicide, a 10% chance of succeeding. I was 26 years old. This is life. One day, then the next. Essie's first birthday arrives. I get a package from Jie, picture books and dresses and 4 boxes of Swiss chocolates, along with a card that says, "Lucia, please give Esperanza a birthday kiss from her auntie. Hope everyone is well. Please be sure to take good care of your health." My health? Well, I'm pretty sure that's Gia's code. It means, "Lucia, take your pills." I give the chocolates to Manny. He devours half a box. He's grilling steaks out on the front porch, freezing his ass off in a t-shirt and gloves. I've baked a cake, put up yellow and white streamers, a birthday banner, hung a donkey piñata above the kitchen sink. Susie would have approved. We light a candle. 1 year. Already 1 year. Only 1 year. It feels like my baby's been on this earth forever. Christmas comes, sneaks down the chimney. New Year rings itself in while I sleep. Essie goes bipedal. She wobbles, she toddles. She's off to explore. I'm chasing after her. That winter is so crazy. One storm trailing into the next, and Mindy Griffin's interviewing traffic cops and plow drivers and power line technicians, and every meteorologist in the tri-state area revels in the snowfall numbers like a rah-rah sport. Driving is slow. I shovel out the car, fight with neighbors over parking spots, which they claim with crates and cones and folding chairs, a toy wagon full of stuffed animals. Our neighbors. They can be fierce. Manny takes on double shifts at the diner. He's stressed about money. Whenever his mommy calls, he's broody for days and won't say why. When he works late, he drives himself home. One night, he spins off an icy patch near the reservoir and skids into a ditch. Luckily, it's before dawn. No other cars on the road. Luckily, it doesn't happen 300 feet later, where he would have crashed through the guardrail into the water and ended up on the Channel 9 news. Manny refuses to flag anyone for help, so he starts walking home. Goes about half a mile when a police car pulls up alongside him. He's terrified. The officer asks if he needs assistance, and might he know whose car has been left back there? Poor Manny. Luckily, the cop isn't a dick. Luckily, Manny isn't hurt. But the car is totaled, and the accident freaks him out, and he can't sleep for weeks. He stays up all night watching telenovelas, complains of stomach pains, and when he does sleep, he grinds his teeth so hard, it's worse than a dental hygienist with a metal scaler. "Are you okay?" I say. He just looks at me with his dog brown eyes. But he doesn't bring up what I think he's going to bring up. The papers. So I don't either. It's awkward, complicated, and the truth is, I don't want to get married again. Not like this, anyway. But for Manny, well, it occurs to me that maybe there's one thing he's more scared of than getting deported. Me. Maybe that's why we're both tiptoeing around.
"Freddy has been sick again. Mommy's worried," he says.
Freddy, his youngest brother, born slow, with a defective heart and coughs and constant chest infections, who is always running out of air. Poor Freddy. I go to the Chinese herbalist who sells me 6 packages of herbs for a weak pulse, diagnosed as qi deficiency. Mommy will need a special clay pot to brew the tonic, so I find a pretty mustard yellow one with bamboo leaves painted on the side. I bundle it with 3 for $5 I Heart NY t-shirts and bubble wrap, along with detailed preparation instructions. Packages to Ecuador need to be sent via courier, but when I tell them it's medicine, they refuse to take it. I bring the herbs home, wrap them in tissue paper in a pretty red box, take it back another day. I tell them it's seasonings for soup.
"Thank you," says Manny.
"De nada," I say. I hope Freddy is okay, because no matter what kind of illness, being sick really sucks.
Deep February. I land an interview for my dream job. At last! Feature reporter for a regional daily. The interviewer's name is Dirk.
"NYU? English major,"
he says, nodding. Tall and blonde with a dimpled smile. Curly bedhead hair, just disheveled enough to redeem his unfortunate mint-green shirt. Turns out we graduated from NYU 4 years apart. He asks if I worked at the paper there. I never worked at the paper, but we play the name game and figure out we both had the same academic advisor,
Not a bad guy. Brilliant writer.
Decent lecturer. Kind of odd.
A little awkward.
In that turtle-like professorial way,
he says. He's gracious. We bond over our shared lukewarm enthusiasm.
What did you do in college?
I tell the truth. I pondered. A lot. Probably too much.
I minored in ponderance,
he says. We discuss classes, dorms, graduate school, and then my internships, the paper, the job, the culture, the expectations.
Your book is good,
he says. He flips through my clips, pauses at my piece on Vietnamese brides.
What'd you think of Hanoi?
He asks. Rich. Rich for the senses, for the soul. I gush, feeling stupid. But it turns out he's been there. He gets it. Dirk has seen so much of Asia, it's intimidating. He points to my piece on El Pollo Loco, never published, but I stuck it in anyway.
This one is good, too. Why haven't you worked at a daily before?
Just busy, I guess. He glances at the bottom of my resume, the part with the additional information. Fluent in English, Spanish, Portuguese, Chinese, some Hebrew, violin, electric bass. He raises his eyebrows.
Electric bass?
I smile, and he smiles, shows his celebrity teeth. He worked his way through college playing drums in wedding bands, and somehow I'm not surprised.
This all looks very good, he says. We'll do the standard reference checks, but it all looks good. I should be able to get back to you in a couple of days.
I shake his hand. It's warm and dry and firm. That weekend, I'm buoyant, giddy, like a schoolgirl waiting to be asked to prom. Nipa calls. It's one of those warm teaser days in early March, and she's meeting some friends down at Writer's Park. Sure, I'll join. Essie walks, all 22 pounds of her tottering from side to side. She's like some mythical creature, freshly hatched, embodying awe and delight as she stomps through a mud puddle. Stop that! It's dirty! I hear the words in my head, but I don't let them out. I let her stomp away. Nady is beautiful, cherubic as ever. Nipa glows, too. Something about her feels different now, lighter. She's found a new job at an at-risk youth center in Harlem, which is something she's always wanted to do. I tell her about the interview. Oh, that sounds perfect, she says. And all those points of connectivity. It's perfect. You're going to get it for sure. You think so? You think so, she says, all go-go girl. That's what matters, right? On Monday, I wait. On Tuesday, I wait. When 6 days have passed, I send a polite email. The reply pops up right away.
Hi, Lucia. I enjoyed speaking with you as well, but unfortunately, we don't feel it's the right fit for our organization. Sorry for not getting back to you sooner. I wish you the best of luck, D.
I stare at my computer screen so long the letters start to wiggle. I blink them back into shape. First, it's so abrupt. Second, it's so final. Third, D?
We have jobs. Diner has jobs, says Manny. Hostess job. Dishwasher. Place across the street has jobs.
I don't say anything. Next one. You'll get it, he says. Next one. I lie on our futon mattress like a gutted fish. Stare up at the ceiling. The paint peels. The crisscross cracks. The dome light fixture. White and opaque. Reminiscent of a silver nippled breast.
Aya, Lucia. She wants to run wild. Cutting school. Sneaking around with boys.
never thinking about future. You think this is fine.
But Ma, Lucia is smart. She'll figure it out. I trace the cracks back and forth with my eyeballs. I look for a sign. If I find a path that traverses the ceiling without crashing into the breast, it means I'll find a job by the end of the month. Manny gives Essie her bath, towels her dry, dresses her in her ducky pajamas. She's had trouble sleeping since she grew out of the bassinet and moved into our bed. When we leave the room, she screams, "Up!" "Maybe we should let her cry it out," I say. But he lies next to her, rubs her back, hooks her fingers on his pinky until she calms. When he sleeps, I touch the mole on his cheek. I ring it like a doorbell. Lucia can do anything she wants. I find my phone. I creep downstairs, shaking. I impulse dial. I hardly ever speak to Gia anymore. We email, and it's sporadic. But for this, she's the only one who will understand. They know.
What are you talking about? What is it, Lucia? What's wrong?
She sounds frantic. I forgot. It's the middle of the night over there. I tell her about the interview. They were about to hire me, and then they didn't. They must know.
About what?
The hospital, my records.
Oh, Lucia.
Now she's yawning. But how would they know? I don't know. It's private. Maybe I'm blacklisted.
Medical records are private. It would be discriminatory.
Anyway, why would you think they know? I tell her about NYU and Ponderance and Vietnam and base, the points of connectivity. I know when a conversation feels right.
Oh, Lucia, she sighs.
What do I do?
Make your bed.
Do I call and ask him why? I can hear the whir of her professional brain evaluating the situation. I guess I don't think so.
Lie in it.
I can't help it. I start to cry. I'm sorry, she says. I don't think there's anything you can do. But it's just one interview, Lucia. I'm sure you'll find something else.
But you don't know.
You're a really good writer. You'll find something. I know you will, Lucia. It will all work out. How is everything else? Is Esperanza okay? Did you get the package I sent? But I'm not in the mood. I head back upstairs, lie next to Essie, listen to Manny's snores.
Why is Lucy crying?
Me? Who am I? Schizophrenia does not define who I am. That night, I float back to my mother's house in New Jersey, the one with the purple swing set in the backyard, green shag carpets, basketball hoop in the driveway. Ma has cancer.
What?
Cancer. Lung cancer.
Oh, my God, Gia. What do we do?
Spring of my junior year at NYU. Gia, at that behemoth consulting firm, working with some telecommunications client, she was miserable. She took charge of everything, the appointments, the follow-ups, the endless research. I was the one living at home in New Jersey that summer, working as a temp, the only summer I didn't go abroad. But Gia was always buzzing around. That was the summer Ma was too weak to move, knocked out by infusions, hospitalized with infections, waiting for transfusions, or, at best, resting in her favorite green suede recliner, listening to her Pavarotti. Sometimes, I'd take out my tall spiral notebook.
Ma, tell me a story.
or if she was too tired for a story. Ma, teach me how to make mapo tofu. It was the summer I learned how to cook, and I jotted down every recipe Ma could remember. Spare ribs with garlic and honey and five-spice powder, lion's head meatballs, almond cookies, cha sho and shrimp-fried rice. Use day-old rice, right, Ma?
Yes, day-old is best. Set the shrimp on a paper towel in front of a fan. To cook up crisp, they must first be dry.
On Christmas Eve, she was declared in remission. We celebrated by roasting a duck, Peking style.
To health, said Jie. To life, said Ma.
And I nearly dropped my cup of baijiu. To be honest, I'd never allowed myself to think she wouldn't survive. The only P-Doc I ever liked was my first, Dr. Hassan, a young Iranian woman with a British accent. Stress, she said. Stress and drugs are the riskiest triggers. You should learn to watch for the signs.
Signs?
Prodromal symptoms, the ones that forecast a break. She focused on wellness, daily routines, proper nutrition, exercise, sleep, and self-care. I never got to bed early, but I ate mostly organic, took brisk walks, practiced yoga and tai chi. And then I met Yona and fell in love. His essence? Something big, bulletproof, with the presence of a rhinoceros. Yet still unassuming, slightly comical, like a duck.
Hey, you, he said that first time we met. I am owner of this store. I give you present. You stop eating from my bulk food aisle.
He handed me a small hexagonal-shaped box, tied clumsily with red ribbon. It was filled with macadamias.
For 1 week, I see you sampling my nuts. You are embarrassed now, he said.
But he said it laughing, because Yoni, only his heart is bigger than his mouth. We played chess, drank wine. I barely even noticed his injured arm. The rest of him was too alive. Shortly after we met, my mother died. That day at her funeral, he stood beside me. I knew he was my angel. Why are you crying? I said, watching him wipe his eyes.
Why you are not crying, he said. Your mother is dead. You are daughter with no mother. I love you. Of course I cry.
We got married, divinely blessed. My thoughts popped like firecrackers. My heart swelled with happiness. My body exuded a magnetic energy. I was an aura of love, a goddess in heat, and people sought out my company to tell me their stories, even virtual strangers. Mrs. Sato, the quiet divorcee, who carried a gun as well as a Pomeranian in her handbag, preferred Indian men and anal sex. Juan Carlos, the Colombian guitarist who rehearsed in the basement, had lymphoma, but refused to let his bandmates know. Mr. Takahara, the multi-millionaire developer, invited me to his private island in the Bahamas, an impulse purchase he'd made the previous winter, to ghostwrite his autobiography. I was the hub of the neighborhood. Hypomania, said Dr. Hassan, is characterized by a pervasive elevated state, euphoria, increased creativity, and productivity. Well, what person in their right mind would want to switch that off? I had every intention of staying that way forever. I didn't catch it in time. The glossy sheen faded. One night I became convinced Yona was broadcasting my life to Israel via the security monitors in our bedroom. I felt devastated, betrayed, and the world's troubles draped over me like a heavy tarp.
Mr. Takahara was falling into bankruptcy. Juan Carlos needed me to cleanse his body's chi. Mrs. Sato beckoned to me with each tilt of her chin. I was a geisha girl, to join in her multicultural orgies. I retreated, suspicious, irritable, overwhelmed.
"What's wrong?"
asked Yona. I couldn't say. The words had fallen out again, and in a rush the voices came. The serpents whispered.
"Her ovaries are shrinking. Her eggs are dying. The baby needs to be born."
A baby trapped inside my ovaries. An actual teeny tiny human, fully formed. She was crying. She needed me. I watched Haka and Noemi in the store, enthralled by their baby boy. How he slept, how he nursed, how he cried to be understood, but never judged or demanded explanations. I could learn. I could love. Like the rest of humankind, I only needed to hold my baby in my arms. Of all the thoughts I was experiencing in those days, these turned out to be the most reasonable, sane. I pretended along in the hospital that time, stayed quiet, played nice. Within a few days, I was released. Sometime later, I said goodbye to Yona. I left Manhattan. I didn't hesitate. Here's the thing. When the serpents come, they seize control via the heart, erase all self-doubt, and life exists only day to day. In those moments, it makes perfect sense to succumb to them and their unwavering conviction. Sometime later, I found myself in another P-ward up north. But when I got pregnant, that tiny being inside me would become my angel. I ditched the pills. I lived my life. 40 weeks truce. Peace. The serpents in hibernation. Then my baby left my body. My Baobao. My Iha. Esperanza. My love. The serpents returned. With a vengeance. Last day of April, I'm offered part-time work. Copywriter for an online vitamin retailer. It's cracker dry, but I learn to extol the benefits of melatonin and colonic cleanses and raspberry ketones. I make them sound irresistible.
"Should we celebrate?" says Manny.
"Why not?" I say. His favorite spot is the Ecuadorian buffet, but it's so warm that weekend I'm in the mood for the beach. So we decide on Croton Point on the Hudson, not far away, and that morning I hear from Nipa, who I haven't seen in 2 months, so I invite her to meet us there, too. It's crowded, a perfect, glorious day, and apparently everyone's had the same idea. We pick a spot, unfurl our blanket. Manny has packed a picnic lunch in a real basket with peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and carrot sticks and cut-up fruit. It's sweet, especially since he doesn't usually like peanut butter or sandwiches, which I say makes him un-American. It's a joke. We watch the kids race up to the water's edge, squeal as it touches their toes. We flick off Essie's shoes, let her run in the sand. A second later, she shoves a wet fistful into her mouth.
"No, no!"
Manny yells. "Let her be," I say, laughing. "How else will she learn?" Seagulls, bold as rats, fat as rabbits, squabble on the shore. As Essie gives chase, their tiny feet patter this way and that, the flock like an organism, a spill of water, magically changing shape. Manny runs after Essie. He's showing her how to skip stones in the water when Nipa arrives. elbows linked with a big, beefy white guy with a bushy beard who's walking bow-legged like a country singer. We hug. "This is my husband, Winston," she says. "Nice to finally meet you," I say. Winston slogs after Nady, who has headed straight for the water. "Is that your husband over there?" Nipa points to Manny, feet submerged in lapping waves. "That's Manny," I say. "I have news." She's beaming. She pats her belly. "Are you pregnant?" 12 weeks. I've been dying to tell someone." "Wow, congratulations," I say. And then I can't help it. I'm picturing Nipa's skinny frame being pounded by Winston, the great woolly mammoth. "How are you feeling?" "Exhausted," she says. "But getting better. Second trimester is so much more tolerable, right?" "Right," I say, though I can't really remember. Pregnancy feels so deep in my own past, and I haven't been able to think of it as a repeat event. Not with all that happened after Essie's birth. "Hey, what happened with that news job? The one you interviewed for?" "Oh, that." I extol the benefits of writing about melatonin and colonic cleanses and raspberry ketones. Make it sound irresistible. And then I hear it.
"Is that you? Lucy, is that you?"
The voice, low and froggy, wafts in the air. But from the surprise on Nipa's face, I know it's real. I whip around to a shock of pink hair, tough, weathered skin, face too small for its buggy eyes. A bull, I think, or a bronco at the gate. Or maybe a slab of beef jerky. Coco. Loco Coco. I haven't seen Coco since the day before I left Croat 6. But it's her, all right, in a white V-neck undershirt and orange tights, still grinding away on her wad of gum.
"Lucy, knew it was you, baby."
Her rough cheek against mine as she hugs me tight.
"This your friend? You got such nice-looking friends, baby. And where's your little girl? Is that her? Oh, my God, you're not kidding. She is too gorgeous. Lord, how time flies. What's it been, a year?"
It comforts me somehow to see she's still the same Loco Coco with her pinball energy, all flashing lights and snapping rubber bands. Her eye, I remember. She stabbed herself in the eye with a chopstick the morning she was supposed to leave the P ward. "How is everything?" I say.
"Grand, just grand, baby. Peach on a day like this? I've been living with my nephew real close by, just for temporary. You been back to the Holiday Inn lately, baby?"
She winks. I shake my head.
"Big one's got a crush on you. Hell, they all do. Who wouldn't, right?"
She's asking Nipa, who nods emphatically. I'm reeling from the dissonance. "Nipa, this is..." Coco's over by the waves, squatting near the kids. Nady shies away.
"Hey, pretty thing. Me, Coco."
She puts out her hand. Essie returns the high five.
"Too gorgeous, just like her mama."
Coco is back, pinches my arm, flashes Nipa her toothy smile.
"Me and this one go way back. She's got a heart of gold. I don't want to keep you, baby. But you're gonna take me to that Chinese joint sometime, right? King crab legs, buffet style. Remember, baby?"
"Sure, Coco. All you can eat."
"I'll give you my number. Got a pen?"
She scribbles on a napkin.
"I'm right up there."
She points to the sky, though maybe she's referring to one of the towns across the river.
"Runs out of control, right? Ta-ta, baby. I gotta run. You call me. So nice to meet."
She waves. Very royal, takes a quick bow, and then she's gone, and the air is still.
"A character," says Nipa.
"Yep, a character," I say. She doesn't ask any more, but it's Winston who lumbers over, all pink and out of breath, huffing.
Who was that crazy lady?
Lucia used to play in a band, says Nipa, as if this should account for such bizarre behaviors, and I'm grateful. Nipa and I talk kids, but personal stuff we still mostly hide away.
Nice friend,
says Manny after they've gone, and I explain how Nipa and I met in the basement of the Unitarian Church. I'm sure I told him before about all the different shaped breasts, but he must not have been listening, because what man wouldn't remember that?
Her and that big dude are one funny couple, though,
he says, and I have to laugh. Sometimes Manny and I get each other like that.
So, what do you think?
He says. He sprawls out on the blanket, all fidgety, scrapes crusted sand off the bottoms of his feet, pops a grape into his mouth.
Maybe it's time to get married, no?
I blink. I look up, as if words are falling out of the clouds. He's not looking at me. He's chewing a grape. So I run to the water. I run in all the way up to my waist. Days pass. Weeks pass. He doesn't say anything, but I feel it in the air sometimes. About what he said, I'm not sure anymore what the words were exactly. Maybe we should get married? Should we get married sometime? Is it time to get married? It might be good to get married? One thing I know it was not. Will you marry me?
Ma, what happened to Ba?
Your father died in an accident.
What kind of accident?
A car accident.
What was he like? How did you meet?
I was arranged to marry another man, but then I fell in love with your father.
That's so romantic.
He was smart, very smart, a brilliant scientist. He could charm a snake with his sweet talk, make a bullfrog laugh. He swept me off my feet, as they say.
But Gong Gong Popo didn't like him.
That's right.
Why not?
Hiya, Xiao Mei. Very complicated. Family matters.
But we don't have family, Ma.
We have three of us, Xiao Mei. Easier this way.
Ma, from a prominent family. Gong Gong Popo, suspicious of Ba, who came from a tiny village in the countryside. But they'd married, had a child, and Ma's family had grown fond of their new son-in-law.
I tell you, with his mouth, no one can resist your Ba.
In the end, it was about money.
Gong Gong Popo loaned your Ba money, a lot of money, some belonging to government. He lost it all. Big shame, big dishonor on family, big disaster for your Gong Gong Popo. They kick us out. This is hard, hard time. Everything wrong. Your Jie, probably too young to remember.
You stayed with him?
Yes.
A waxy glaze settles over her eyes.
I stayed with him. I gave up my family. I thought it was right.
But were you happy?
Happy? Ay-ya, Xiao Mei. You want too much. Don't be greedy. This is too much American.
But you came here to be an American, Ma. You came all alone. Tell me about the airplane.
Ay-ya, the airplane again.
As a child, I ask for this story all the time. Shanghai to Hong Kong, to Honolulu, to San Francisco. A turbulent ride. The fat Guelo beside her vomiting into a paper bag. Not once, not twice, 7 times.
And the lady behind us offers roast pork bun to your Jie. Can you imagine? That fair gong like that, and all Chinese can think of is food.
I was in your belly.
Of course you were. Months you were in there, making me sick. I kept thinking, I'm going to be sick. But you kick me. You say, keep on going.
Were you scared?
No time to be scared. You were waiting to be born.
I was born in Tennessee, full of golden hairs.
How many thousand miles I traveled to give birth to my Baobao in this foreign land. I think I am in a dream. No husband, no family. Only third uncle who agreed to sponsor my visa. And he is not even blood uncle. He is uncle married in from your boss side, who owns a shoe repair shop and speaks Taishanese.
A dialect Ma can barely understand. Were you lonely?
I was free. In China, never free. Your Ba says, to be free, we have to go to America. We make plans. But then...
At this point, her lips draw into a thin red line. She pinches my cheeks, braids my hair, scraping my scalp with bobby pins. When can I go on an adventure, Ma?
Ah, yeah, Xiaomei. You are here in America. We have house with yard and swing set. Good life. I tell you, it's hard to believe.
I have no memories of Tennessee, only memories of the way I pictured Ma there, as a fearless pioneer. I try to imagine it, Manny and me, holding hands before a crusty magistrate. What I see is this: black and white floor tiles, dingy lights, Yoni and me down at City Hall, Jie as our only witness. What was marriage then, but a piece of white paper packed with tiny type, signed by a city clerk? A convention, a formality, hardly relevant, because true love is the only tie that binds. It's what I thought at the time. But now, at night, in the dark, flanked by two sets of breaths, four arms, four legs, a click of teeth. Well, I'm tethered to a different life. But I'm still not sure I want a piece of paper to dictate what it is. I focus on Essie. We'll take a special trip, just the two of us.
T-R-A-I-N! We're taking the T-R-A-I-N! We're taking the T-R-A-I-N to the Big Apple today!
We stroll down Main Street, and everyone smiles as she waves her baby wave, opening and closing her little fist.
Apple, she says. Manzana.
Big apple, I say.
Manzana grande.
She's smart. Holy shit, my baby is smart. I want to flag down a passerby. This man, a biker, another parent with child.
Manzana grande. Did you hear that? 17 months old. Manzana grande.
My baby is smart. We go to Central Park, to the zoo. Jie brought me here as a kid sometimes. We'd buy 2 bags of nuts from the street vendor and imagine all the animals were our relatives.
Auntie Emu from Australia is grumpy again.
African pygmy snake is too shy to say hello.
Where will you live when you grow up, Jia?
Maybe here in New York?
Well, I'm going to live in the whole wide world.
I take Essie to see the gorilla. I beat my chest, and the gorilla presses her nostrils against the window, fogs up the thick wall of glass. Those wary eyes, the leathery black palms. I press my hand to hers.
Essie slaps her pink fingers on the window, too, until a nervous volunteer tells us to stop.
12 more touches.
We pass the bats and frogs, penguins and sea lions, a sloth, a banded mongoose, 2 polar bears. Our last stop is the petting barn,
where goats and sheep and pot-bellied pigs chomp pellets from Essie's hands. The chickens intrigue her. She chases them, and they cluck away, and we're there for half an hour playing